I'm very happy now to welcome, joining us by telephone, Mountaineer Conrad Anker. He will be in Santa Fe tomorrow night in a benefit for Wild Earth Guardians and an event sponsored by the North Face and Sangre de Cristo. It's called Mount Meru, the Center of the Universe, Teamwork and Tenacity in the Himalaya. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary. How are you?
Good, good. It's great to have you on the show. This is the kind of climbing you do, the kind of mountaineering work you do is probably terrifying to even contemplate for most people. You kind of do almost death-defying mountain trips, but tend to survive. Tell us how you got into this whole world of mountain climbing.
I was introduced to the mountains by my parents at a young age in Central California and grew up in the Sierras. And I went from climbing up peaks that had a pretty straightforward approach to them to bigger and more ambitious things, probably like El Capitan. And that was my sort of the next level where I went to was climbing on El Capitan. And that was really the start of it. And then combining winter camping skills with the type of climbing you would find on El Capitan, that's what Himalayan big wall climbing is all about.
So Himalayan big wall climbing, tell us more about what you mean by that.
Well, imagine your worst day of skiing, which is snowing and it's frigid and blowing sideways, but you don't have a ski lift, and you've got the equipment that you need to survive, your tent, your sleeping bag, your stove, your food. And then toss in with that rock climbing of the highest grade, and then on top of that, high altitude. So we're doing all of these at 20,000 feet, which is extreme altitude. So it's sort of a combination of different skills and layering one level of difficulty onto the next each time you progress.
You have to obviously train for a long time and have a lot of different kinds of experiences before you get to a level where you can do that hardest kind of climbing. And I imagine you also don't do it alone. How do you work with other people to accomplish that kind of climbing?
The first step is finding a good team to climb with, and on this team we were with Jimmy Chin and Renan Ozturk. And there's plenty of skilled climbers around, but what you're really looking for is someone that you get along with and that can pick up when you're feeling out of it and has skills that will support you. So there's a combination of them. And then over that is the ability to get along and be friends.
What is the actual, how do I say this? Describe some of the kinds of techniques that you use to do some of those difficult climbs. Like, what is the actual technology for getting up these extremely difficult mountains?
The rope is primarily your safety net, and as you go up, you put pieces of protection in, and they're little bits of aluminum and steel that are about the size of cracks, which are weaknesses, and you put them in there, and they kind of stop in there. They set into a constriction. You use a carabiner. You clip your rope through there. That's the very basic part of it. And then belaying is the act of securing the rope from below. So that's your safety network that we use as climbers. And you sort of centipede one pitch after another going up the mountain. And that's the climbing technique. On this climb, which we'll be sharing tomorrow night about Meru, we're sleeping in portaledges, which are rectangular cliff tents that you sit on the side of the mountain with, and we got stuck in a five-day storm up there, and that was kind of the sort of getting us excited about it and the culmination of all these different techniques.
Sleeping in the cold on the side of a mountain seems really scary and uncomfortable. What is it actually like?
Unless you happen to like it. If you happen to like it, then you're living large, so, and I happen to like it. I think it's a fun thing to do. So to me, it's just like being a kid and I'm playing fort and I'm going back to what it was like when I was a young man. So, but on this instance, it would be, we were always constantly battling cold temperatures and conditions that were, the wind was blowing, and then having to stay in there. We really didn't have enough food to get through and a great level of comfort.
Well, that's another big question, is what kind of food you eat on a climb like that, that is lightweight enough to carry, that is nourishing enough to eat, and that you can really digest at high altitudes.
Yeah, it's a challenge. We eat oatmeal and supplement that with soy protein in the morning, and then we'll have an energy bar or two during the day, and then in the evening we would have dehydrated beans with olive oil and a little bit of cheese. So, but we went up with 8 days of food, and we spent 19 days on the route, and even a second grader can do the math on that. So we ran out of food. It was pretty grim.
What did you do?
Well, we rationed food, and you just realize that the human body is pretty strong. We can do with a lot less calories than what we think we need, and then you can sort of go on willpower, and you start metabolizing your body and your organs. It's not a good thing to do, but every once in a while, it probably builds character.
Now, Mount Meru, the center of the universe, teamwork and tenacity in the Himalaya, that's the title of the presentation that you're going to be giving, along with photographer Jimmy Chin, whom we'll talk about in a second. Why the center of the universe?
For the Hindu religion, the Garhwal is the source of the Gangotri and the river Ganges. So in the Ganges River is the most holy river for the Hindu religion. And the peaks that surround the glacier where this starts from are all of special religious significance. And Meru is behind Shivling, which is the abode of Lord Shiva, and it's known as the center of the universe. So it's in deference to their religion, not in any Jules Verne type thing or some sort of Western ego that, oh, we were so cool that we could go to the center of the universe. It was the name, Meru means center of the universe for in the Hindu religion.
Right. So do people in this area, in the Himalaya, do they climb mountains, or is it only sort of crazy nuts from the West like us?
There are mountain climbers from India. The mountain climbing for your average person is you have to have a fair amount of resources, and that includes time to practice the craft and do it. And in the West, we have that because of our highly materialistic, consumeristic society. So many of the people are living in a subsistence existence. Mountain climbing is the last thing they'd ever want to do. That being said, the growing middle class in India, there are a lot of really keen climbers. And we ran into expeditions from Mumbai, from Delhi, that were up there, and they were climbing, and it was great to interact with them. But the local villagers, they're not climbers.
How do they respond to the expeditions of people who come in? They're not climbers themselves. What do they think of you?
The villagers that are lower elevation, they're fine with it. It's a source of income. We try to employ as many people as we can, and there's the multiplier effect of the money that we bring into their communities. And then at the base camp, it's a holy place, and there's a lot of sadhus and matajis, which are holy people, and they're kind of just like a New Yorker cartoon sitting on the side of the mountain and answering the questions of the seekers. And for these holy people, climbing in the mountains, they think it's pretty cool. They're like, you guys are on your own spiritual quest too, and we can relate to it. And what's it like when you go out there, and did you see things that we have in our literature about these mountains? Are they there? So they're really they're supportive of it, and we're not breaking any rules about, oh, it's a sacred mountain, or please don't climb there.
Did you ever ask them any big questions?
Well, the sadhus,
yeah,
probably so. I mean, I guess the one to take away from it is that enlightenment is not found on a full belly or a soft bed. So for the sadhus that live up there in a cave at 14,000 feet on flour and tea and praying all day long and basically living in a pretty minimal existence, for them, it's they're sort of the same way to do that. So, but they're also very aware. We would have conversations with the people up there about climate change, about receding glaciers, and sort of looking at things in a geologic cosmic time frame.
We're talking to mountaineer Conrad Anker. So there really is kind of a similarity in their quest and yours. I mean, how would you describe your quest? It seems like more than just, I mean, I don't know if you would call it a spiritual quest or whatever, but it seems like something comes from a very deep place in you.
We're motivated by something I have yet to pin down after 34 years of climbing, so it's kind of still a mystery. But I guess it's this, humans have always had this drive to explore and to find out what the world is about, and that's why we're the dominant species on this planet, and we've been able to harness our intellect and create machines and little things that make life better, to understand agriculture and to domesticate animals. And we're really, I mean, because of that, humans, we have too many of us on this planet. So there's that elemental part of it. And I think that as alpinists and mountaineers, and what we're doing is that this drive for knowledge, this looking to the unknown, and this quest to seek out risk and to pit yourself against it and to bring it back and tell a story is as timeless as humans are. And that in a very odd, small, humble way, we're keeping this risk, keeping the risk gene alive and healthy in our culture.
There's also risks that don't pan out very well. You were on a climb with your dear friend Alex Lowe, and in an avalanche, he lost his life and you survived.
That was, yes, 10 years ago. And it's climbing is very dangerous. It's more so than motor racing or many of the other high-risk sports. And so it's one is very aware of that. And to practice the sport of high-altitude climbing in the Himalaya, one needs to come to terms with death, to make peace with it, and to realize that how fragile and how fleeting life really is, and that it's important to live it to its fullest each day.
For someone who climbs glaciers, their disappearance or their shrinking because of climate change has a whole other dimension than it does even for the rest of us.
Yeah, a very accurate observation, Mary. And it's one of these things where the changing of our Earth's atmosphere, the fact that CO2 levels have gone up from 250 parts per million when we founded our nation to about 380 parts per million, and the trapping of greenhouse gases, and the anthropogenic alteration of the Earth's climate, it's happening, and we're a result of it because coal-fired electrical plants, driving automobiles, the life that we live, and I'm as guilty as the next person. And glaciers are the most obvious physical manifestation of a warmer planet. And you can't say, well, the glaciers, they're doing fine. I mean, they're not. And something as simple as photographs illustrate how much the glaciers are shrinking and receding. So there's a lot of science out there that is letting us know that we are changing the state of our planet, and that we need to be thinking about how we're going to leave the Earth for future generations.
You work with photographer Jimmy Chin, who will also be at this presentation tomorrow night, Mount Meru, the Center of the Universe, Teamwork and Tenacity in the Himalaya. And by the way, that's there's a reception at 6 o'clock and the presentation at 7 o'clock at the Armory for the Arts here in Santa Fe. Jimmy is not only a mountaineer, but a photographer. That adds yet another dimension of both beauty and, I would imagine, risk to the whole endeavor of mountain climbing.
Yeah, and Jimmy is one of the world's best outdoor photographers. He's a great climber and skier, and is by just alone that. And then he's able to take the camera up there and take his skills and use them to share the story of being in the mountains with more than just a few people.
His photography is stunning, and I guess people will get a chance to see it at this event. How do you work with him? How do you, as a climber, assist in the whole endeavor of photography?
Well, probably in this instance, sort of the teamwork of getting the equipment up there and sharing the load that we have to carry, and then being a subject for his photographs, being there with in them. So that's pretty key.
Now, you were on the trek to find the first man who climbed Mount Everest. Is that correct?
Yeah. In 1999, on the 1st of May, I discovered the frozen and well-preserved body of George Lean Mallory, who had disappeared 75 years earlier in 1924 on the north side of Mount Everest. And it was a great story, whether or not they could have made it up to the summit. And it's a very wonderful story. There's a film that we've been working on titled The Wildest Dream that's due out early next year that's about that. So there's more information if you're interested. You can also look me up online, and there's I have a book I've written about it. So it's a pretty fascinating story.
I mean, it's unbelievable. How did you actually find the body, the man himself?
There were a little bit of a clue was shared with Western climbers in 1975. A Chinese expedition came across an English dead, and that's how they described it. And we knew that there was two fatalities pre-Second World War on Mount Everest, and those were George Mallory and Sandy Irvin. So with that information, we knew that it was one of those two climbers that had disappeared.
One of the things that I think is most important about being a successful climber is knowing when it's time to turn around, even if you haven't hit the summit yet. How do you make that judgment?
Well, part of it is intuitive. You know that, okay, the situation isn't favorable anymore. We don't have enough reserves to make it back safe and sound, and that you play your cards accordingly. And the main thing is you don't want to get into a situation where you have a small accident that would then sort of catapult into something larger and more challenging.
In Mount Meru, was that a decision you had to make?
Yeah, we didn't make it to the top. We got to within, well, probably two or three pitches, and we just realized that it wasn't in the cards, so we had to turn back. And that's part of the story that we will share with your listeners tomorrow, and it's it'd be great to say, oh, here it is, a heroic tale, make it to the top of the mountains. But you learn more from your mistakes, and that's we all know that. And I learned quite a bit on this trip about what I could do and how our team functioned and a lot of other things like that. So it was pretty important to have that all together.
Conrad Anker is a mountaineer, and once again, he and mountaineer and photographer Jimmy Chin will be at the Armory for the Arts tomorrow night, Tuesday, October 27th. There is a VIP reception at 6 o'clock, which you can buy tickets for from Wild Earth Guardians, and then a presentation for the general public at 7 o'clock. And for more information, people can go ahead and give Wild Earth Guardians a call. Conrad Anker, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Mary, thank you very much, and big shout-out to the folks at NPR. You guys rock.
Thank you so much. And by the way, the presentation is called Mount Meru, Center of the Universe, Teamwork and Tenacity in the Himalaya. Conrad Anker's website is Conrad Anker, that's A-N-K-E-R, conradanker.com. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR is streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Cabby for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the colors of jazz.